Does life have meaning? Is there any purpose to our suffering here on Earth? Or is it all just a cosmic joke? I think it's best not to dwell on your eventual death, but think about improving the limited time you have here on Earth. And you can start with the simple step of making better coffee. That's right, listeners, suffering is inevitable, but bad coffee doesn't have to be. So don't you think it's time to switch to Sparkplug coffee? Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. That is something you're not going to find at your local cafe or grocery store. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for podcast listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The offer doesn't apply to any of the gear they carry, but it does apply to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. The time's never been better to start making the best cup of coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Are you there, God? It's me, Ingmar. Oh, he's not there. He's out drinking coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hallo and tak for spending some time with the Next 100 Project, the classic movies podcast that is just a few weeks shy of 5 years old. And for nearly 5 years, we've been spoiling motion pictures, which we'll be doing today too. I'm your non-Swedish host, Ryan Ellis, and here's my lovely, also very Canadian and non-Swedish wife, Bev.
That's me.
All right, well, I mentioned that we're about to turn five. We'll be celebrating our wood anniversary at the end of March, and also we'll post our 250th podcast at the end of April.
Wow.
250th overall, all the iterations, not 100s, top 100s, next 100s, and so on.
I'm impressed. We're impressive.
It's a lot of time. Well, we're going to have our wedding anniversary in May as well.
It's true.
So an anniversary in March and an anniversary in May of different kinds. Also, this is the day after the Oscars when we post this podcast. A lot happened. So much. Can you believe they gave it to Moonlight again? You'd think those underdogs were sick of winning, but no. Of course, we're recording this podcast before the Oscars, so we don't know what happened. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Cries and Whispers. Which well-known American producer got the rights to distribute the movie in America? And this name will surprise you.
Roger Corman? Mm-hmm. How did that even happen?
Talk about a weird marriage. Roger Corman, Ingmar Bergman.
Well, he probably got a deal. I suspect Roger Corman really only ever cared about making money, and he saw that nobody was picking it up, and he knew he could get it for a steal.
It's funny, because Bergman was a legend by this point.
But he had made two poorly performing films prior to this. He struggled to get it funded in the first place. He personally put in like half of the budget of the film, which was the equivalent to like $200,000 American.
Oh, I thought he put all the money in.
He just put a lot. He got some funding as well, and he got a lot of people to work on deferred payment. Lucky for him, the film did turn a profit, although apparently Roger Corman took home a significant amount of that profit. Knew how to market it, I suppose.
And the Next 100 Project's 97th motion picture, Cries and Whispers, was screened in New York in very late 1972. Then Svensk Film Industry released it in Sweden 45 years ago today on March 5th, 1973. So how about that? A foreign language film gets released in America first and then more wide in its original country, in this case Sweden. It did pretty well over there and ended up being Ingmar Bergman's biggest hit this side of the Atlantic. Bev, I don't think people know much about this movie, or forgot what it's about, so explain it now with the Ingmar Bergman Cries and Whispers skinny.
It is 19th century Sweden, and we are in the elaborate home of three grown sisters and their maid, who are seeing through the last miserable days of dying middle sister Agnes. Her suffering and the agony of waiting for her to die amplify the strained relationships these three sisters share, especially when juxtaposed with the selfless warmth displayed by Agnes's loyal maid, Anna.
Or, in a nutshell, I've said it before and I'll say it again, family doesn't work.
That's a Simpsons reference.
Yep. Or, 12 years a nurse.
Oh my god, that's perfect.
All right, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 89% of critics liked the film, 24 fresh and 3 rotten. So, only 27 reviews in total. And 91% of audiences. The Swedish title of this movie is Viskningar och Rop. I won't be saying that again. And we'll probably mispronounce people's names a lot in this podcast. In fact, I know Karen is pronounced Karen or Corin even. Maybe Corin's more like it. Mm. So if we mispronounce people's names, we apologize right now. What did you think of the 19th century chamber piece that's quiet, rich with symbolism? I think it's great, but it's not easy to watch.
This is the third Ingmar Bergman film I've seen. The other two are The Seventh Seal and Persona, which I love.
Maybe the two most famous ones he's ever made.
I didn't love Cries and Whispers the same way. It was super interesting, and it was very enlightening to read about the film. Like, I really enjoyed doing the research part, but I found it just didn't get to me while I was watching it. I should find this film the most relatable. I am the baby of three sisters, one of whom is estranged and I have a very difficult relationship with. I can't explain it. It just didn't get under my skin, but it was at least a very interesting film, and I think we're going to have a really good, meaty conversation about it.
We've used that word interesting a lot the last few months, and of course in Hollywood speak that means I hated it. When we say it, it's usually a compliment, because you can't say you love a movie like this, or Melancholia, for example.
But I do love Melancholia.
And I think love is the wrong word for that movie.
I love The Seventh Seal, especially. That one is my favorite of the three I've seen. And it's an interesting film. It's very cerebral, and it's very foreign in every possible way. But it worked for me in a way that, I don't know, this film just didn't work. But reading the reviews, there's so much passion for it, and so many people consider this Bergman's masterpiece. I actually wonder if I was just not in the right mood, in the right mindset to watch a Bergman film, because you kind of have to be.
I'm in the camp of the people that think it's his best film. It is funny that you didn't relate to it, even though you're the woman, and it's mostly women in this movie, and I'm the guy, and I related to it the first time I saw it. Now, I don't remember when I did see this movie. It might be that this movie hits me so hard. Well, it didn't hit me that hard anymore, but it connects with me the way that it still does after, I think, 4, maybe even 5 viewings. Is because of the cancer angle. Now, maybe it was the early 2000s when my uncle was dying of cancer, and he died over the course of about 8 months. He was a tough bastard, lived a long time, and withered away. That's one thing about this movie, though. It's a bit of a criticism. It is the Hollywood cancer. She doesn't look that bad for somebody who's got uterine cancer and does die of it in the storyline.
Well, she's an actress pretending to have uterine cancer. There's only so much bad she can look.
Right, but movies have done this a little better. Patricia Clarkson in The Green Mile, I just happen to see the scene where she's at the end, where she probably would die, but then, spoiler alert on Green Mile after all these years, John Coffey, like the drink, only not spelled the same, rips the cancer out of her with his magical powers and saves her. But before he does it, she looks awfully bad. And I don't think in Pet Sematary, the woman has cancer in the flashback sequence, the sister, but she also looks awful. Agnes looks bad, but not really that bad.
Fair enough. So this is your favorite Bergman film, despite the fact that you should be able to relate to it least because all the main characters are women.
That's a Bergman thing, though. He did women-driven movies more often than not. Persona is almost entirely two women. I think that's a great film. It's not my favorite of his three. He did a lot more than three movies, but it's not my favorite of his big ones, whatever, 5 or 6, whatever his biggest titles are. He did a lot of movies, though, with women at the center of them.
And I would say that his spiritual heir, the filmmaker who most closely resembles his tone, would be Lars von Trier, who's a filmmaker that we both love and hate. And like we said, Melancholia is a film we love. And he's another filmmaker who makes films primarily about women's suffering. And one of the great things about Bergman films is when you dive deep into researching what people write about it and people say about it, is there's a lot of academic and almost philosophical thought about it, and people really like to dig deep into exactly what he meant by everything and why he makes one choice over another. And a lot of these articles talk about why he makes so many films about women, and the kind of academic philosophical angle that they take is feelings are universal. The feelings that they have of either guilt or shame or anger or fear of intimacy or almost over-intimacy in the case of Marie.
Obsession with God, religion, death are also themes that Bergman went back to over and over again.
And these are all universal themes that both men and women feel. But there's an easier access to feelings when you're relating to women, because women can just more readily express feelings without it seeming bizarre. So maybe he chose women as his subjects because it's simply easier to express emotions with actresses.
I'm not going to call him out on this one because I don't know if that it's true. But in these movies that are women-driven that he did over and over again, they go through hell. They suffer. I don't mean they were put through hell to make the movie. They didn't throw shit at them or put them through awful situations or put them on a frozen fjord and let them sit there with no clothes on for the sake of a scene. But the characters they're playing go through shit. Bad shit.
Much like von Trier as well.
Yeah, and von Trier also had a self-mutilation scene of genitals. His is worse, von Trier's is much worse than what we see in this movie, but I've never forgotten, it's been ingrained in my brain ever since, when Cotton they say that she cuts her own clitoris off. You don't see any of that. You do see that in Antichrist. But she does enough to get the gist that she's cut into herself somehow. And I never, ever forgot it. And I saw this movie first time so long ago.
I thought she was going to try and kill herself. You know, there's a long scene with her with the glass. You know she's going to do something. You've already seen the red wine spill. There's already this primer that blood is coming. I did not expect her to mutilate her genitals. Simply to, I think, avoid sex with her husband. That's what's implied. And then she wipes the blood on her face. Yep. It's this vulgar and gruesome thing. And in the rest of the film, in every other scene you see her, and she's actually tremendously controlled, despite some pretty awful things happening. She seems to be the most controlled person. And there's some robust debate about the nature of Bergman's portrayal of women in his films. I'm usually of the mind that portraying oppression or suffering is not like inflicting oppression or suffering.
Yeah.
And like the Lars von Trier movies, they depict women suffering. They're portraying real complex part of humanity. Women suffer sometimes. Is it controversial to portray that in art? I disagree with that as a feminist criticism, that he hates his actresses or he hates his female characters and so he makes them suffer.
Brian De Palma was accused of that too, and I don't think De Palma hated his characters either.
As a matter of fact, these are some of the most rich, deep characters that you see in cinema, especially in the 70s. I would take this over 100 nameless wives sitting at home wringing their hands over what their husband is doing, who's like the real hero of the film. The reactress, as we've called many times before, the kind of nothing character who's just there to say, stop, are you going to come home? Just that kind of nothing part that has no real depth to it. I would take 100 suffering women characters in films like this that are so much more interesting and convey a real human experience over that generic Hollywood female role.
As great as The Godfather is, they're guilty of having no good female roles. Diane Keaton plays the reactress, doesn't really do anything interesting in any of the movies. Well, maybe the third one, actually, as much as that movie takes heat. And some about the second movie. Actually, quite a bit in the second, but in the first one, not really. And Talia Shire doesn't do that much. We don't even know anything about the mother in the first movie.
Yeah,
so as great as The Godfather is, and that was released around the same time as this was. Well, they're not comparable, but actually that's the point, is that you got almost entirely men, and now you've got almost entirely women.
Mm. And so you talked about Karen cutting off her own clitoris. I didn't realize that that's what she was doing, but she's definitely mutilating her.
That's what they say online, so I'm going to believe what people are saying about that. But yeah, she's cutting herself in a way that implies, I'm not going to fuck you anymore.
My genitals are mutilated. We are not having sex anymore. Each of the women are supposed to represent a different aspect of, well, a personality. He says that the film was inspired by his mother, whose name was Karen.
Right, yeah.
So he says that each of these women, each of the characters, represent like an aspect of his mother's personality. They all have like a different fatal flaw. Karen is that she just simply is incapable of intimacy with anyone. Maria is that she's too capable of intimacy and that she leaves herself open and vulnerable and makes poor decisions. Agnes is hard to tell. She's just the manifestation of pain and mortality. And Anna, of course, is the one who takes care of everybody else and not herself, who just loves everyone else. Although, I think the movie very strongly implies that even though Anna seems very much like a pitiful character through much of the film, by the end of the film, you're pretty confident she's the one they should all envy. Because she's the one who's going to be okay.
She's definitely the best person of all of them.
By a country mile. Which is why she's going to be okay. The movie, which is so bleak and so dark, ends on this really beautiful, optimistic note when it's Anna reading Agnes's diary. Agnes is dead now, and she's taken her diary, and the diary just describes this totally plain event. The three sisters and Anna are walking on a beautiful day, and they sit on a swing set, and it's just this little captured moment. She was having a good day, and she enjoyed herself, and she knew in that moment to enjoy herself and just live in the moment and say, well, this is as good as it gets. This is life at its best, and this happened, and I got to have it, and that is something.
She was finding simple pleasures with loved ones, and it reminds me about some of the lines in American Beauty, the voiceover that Spacey has. He's grateful for his stupid life, and she's grateful for her life. He's dead, and she probably knows she's going to die because she has cancer for so long.
She definitely had cancer at that point. Because she has a line in the diary, it wasn't a particularly bad day for pain. And the only reason her two sisters are there to look after her. Because they don't seem to have a lot of love for each other. They wouldn't really voluntarily spend time together were it not for the catastrophe of Agnes dying.
The four women are the main characters, and Bergman dreamed of four women wearing white in a red room whispering. That's where the inspiration for this movie came from. And all the red and white, especially in some of the scenes early on, made me feel very at home as a Canadian. All those white outfits and the red rooms.
There's so much red in those rooms. It's not just the walls, it's the carpet, it's the drapery. It's like they are inside. Well, he says that he always imagined a soul to be red.
Or even a uterus.
Or a uterus, I know, I was thinking that too. And for Agnes, although I never picked this up on the film, I read it afterwards, that she has uterine cancer. Mm. That's what's killing her. So everything is so female-centric. They're in a womb. They're in their childhood home. And the first scene of the film, they're all wearing white as well. Mm. Well, like you said, he had the dream of the women in white.
The movie also uses frames of nothing but red. It even fades to red sometimes. Just like in Clockwork Orange with their big frames of red or different colors in general. The end credits of Clockwork Orange are just big blocks of color with the text on the screen. And that was only a few years before this movie too. Clockwork Orange was, well, basically a year before this came out in America. They shot the movie in a dilapidated mansion and they had carte blanche to redesign the whole dump.
They picked it because they could absolutely do anything they wanted with it because nobody cared what happened to that house.
You'd never know. It was a shithole though. The mother character that we see a little bit and we hear enough about has been dead for 20 years, and it suggests these kids can't truly grow up because they aren't very mature. Maria especially. We don't know enough about Agnes to know what she would be like if she wasn't dying of a horrible disease. But the most interesting character in the movie, I think, is Karen. She's mean, but she has the most interesting stuff. And it's funny that Liv Ullmann, who plays Maria, didn't play Karen because she was the muse of Bergman. They were dating at this point. I think they may have even had some kids or a kid.
One of their kids is in the film.
Bergman was known to be a dater of his actresses. Ullmann wasn't the only one he ever slept with. But I think maybe the best role isn't even with the best actress. And maybe that was deliberate. We'll say, oh, you can have the lesser role this time. We'll give this one to Ingrid Thulin, who had worked with him before in Wild Strawberries and The Silence. She worked for 40-plus years. And she's just got, I think, the best character in the film. What do you think about that? The nurse is good, too, but I think that Karen's just better.
I think the nurse kind of sneaks up on you, and you don't realize until after you've seen the film that she is the most important character in the film. Maybe just
the contrast. Not the best.
Okay, the best. I think I have to agree with you, although it's really hard to choose. Even Agnes herself, all she does is suffer.
She does it well.
She really does do it well. It's visceral and authentic. She doesn't look that bad, but when she's in pain and she's suffering, she said she based it on her own father's death. She saw her father die of cancer, and so she just channeled that, and it is something else to behold. There are just scenes after scenes where she's breathing this horrible...
Yeah, it's almost a horror movie at that
point. Laborious, yeah, which I have heard is exactly what happens eventually, is that your lungs are struggling to breathe because she's dying. But maybe Karm becomes the most important character, or seems like the meatiest character, perhaps because it's better casting or better writing or she just did a better job than Liv Ullmann. But I can see how Maria would have at the very least been intended to be just as important of a character as Karen.
Well, they're
all important. Has a lot of story. Like, she has a pretty rich story that she's cheating on her husband and she witnesses her husband's suicide attempt and does nothing to save him and still wants to carry on an affair with the doctor who's very unnecessarily cruel to her. Ironically, pointing out every wrinkle on her face as if he's not like 20 years her senior. Maybe it's also because she has to exude this effortless sexuality, which she absolutely does. It's not just in her clothes and her big hair, but there's just something about her that's so innately sexy.
Well, she wants a penis inside of her uterus, or at least her vagina, I should say. And Karen destroys her vagina in the flashback scene. And of course, the main character, if you want to call her that, Agnes, it's got uterine cancer.
And it's presumed that Agnes is a virgin. She's a spinster. She was never married. So as far as we know, she never had any affairs. Her flashback isn't about romance. It's not about a lover of any kind. Her flashback is simply about the jealousy she had about her mother loving Maria more than she loved her. Her mother, played by also Liv Ullmann, in the flashbacks. Clearly, you're supposed to believe that maybe Maria is most like her mother. We never learn how her mother died, but we do learn that she had a sadness, like a melancholy. So, who knows?
Anna, the nurse, who is their mother figure, is practically a saint. And then we see the Pietà image at one point. Also that great close-up. So many intense close-ups in this movie. But when Agnes is saying, "You're so good to me," and she's suffering, it's right before, I believe, that scene where she's breathing so heavily in that horror scene almost. And only Anna bothers to try to know Agnes. She reads her diary, and she's always there for her. The other two sisters are there, but they're not really as truly present as they could be or maybe should be.
And when Agnes is at her very worst, She's just crying out for Anna. She wants her to come help her. Her sisters are there and they're helpless. They don't know what to do for her. Anna's the only one that can comfort her.
And the comfort scene early on is one of the most intimate I've ever seen in movie history. Even though there's a little bit of nudity in there, it's not sexual at all. This is a very intimate movie. And it's a movie that's all about intimacy is more important than sex anyway. Maria doesn't seem to know that, but Agnes and Anna sure do.
All portrayals of intimacy in the film, especially the really authentic ones between Agnes and Anna, are designed to make you, I think, a little uncomfortable. Either because of the undistilled vulnerability she bares her breasts and lets Agnes lie on her like a mother. Or because you, as a viewer, feel strongly like you're intruding on these characters. You shouldn't be witnessing this. And then there's also scenes of intimacy that feel forced or inauthentic. And in that case, I'm talking about Maria and Karin, who near the end, I think it's after Agnes dies and they're kind of distraught. Maria starts saying, "We used to be close and you're my sister." And finally she breaks through to her after a great deal of resistance. And they have this long scene. You don't hear what they're saying, but you just see them talking to each other very closely and touch each other's faces so much. And it made my skin crawl. Like, it's weird. Why should that make my skin crawl?
But it's like Travolta with Idina Menzel. With
the Oscars. Yes, so uncomfortable.
My wickedly talented Idina Menzel.
No, don't do that.
I think the point of that scene is just making up. That's why we don't hear the dialogue. It doesn't matter what they're saying.
But then they don't make up because the very next day it's...
Well, they did
it's
at
as
that
if
point.
It never happened. Yeah, it's as though they had sex and she regrets it. And she's like, "I don't even remember that. And my husband's waiting for me." Excellent performance, because you actually see her reluctance. If it was up to me, if I didn't have this husband waiting for me outside, and if you didn't have your husband, if we really were just going to carry on living in this house as we have been, then maybe there could be something there and we could explore this. But the fact is, my life being what it is makes it impossible for you and I to grow close like we almost did.
And maybe they'll never see each other again because this connection they had is not even in their life anymore because she's dead. And Agnes does die in the middle of the movie. It's one of those kinds of films where more than half is after what you expect to be the end of the movie. You expect that to be the climax, but it's not at all. We don't even see the funeral, which is unusual for a movie of this type.
Well, it's so rare that this film leaves the house, only for these little interludes outside in the garden. But it's not the last we see of Agnes, because she has her resurrection.
Mm-hmm. She's a zombie.
It's like a half-dream fantasy. You're kind of left wondering a little bit if it's really happening
or not.
No,
I don't think it is.
No, no, you're not. It's not really overtly a dream. It's a little bit weird in just the way it seems to have at least a toe planted in reality. It's Anna's dream. This is one of the many Jesus imagery things that takes mm-hmm. place in the film. Agnes has all these Jesus-y type things happen to her. She's suffering, and she dies in kind of like a Christ pose. And they even pose her feet to be one on top of the other the way his is in those crucifixion imagery, and her arms are out. Mm. And then, of course, she's resurrected in a dream, but she is resurrected. If there's anything that I'll watch again in this film, it will definitely be the scene of her resurrection. The worst part, to me, of the resurrection, even though it's kind of about each individual character coming to terms with what Agnes's death means to them, and it's a very different reaction that all three of them have. But the worst part to me is that Agnes, even though she's dead, is still suffering. She's lonely now, but you at least thought that after she died, that she no longer had to be in pain anymore. But there she is, still suffering.
Not a fun thought. This is an atheist for you with Bergman.
So like the reluctant atheist, he believes there is no God, or at the very least God has abandoned us, and he's always exploring the theme and trying to prove the point that we live in a godless world. And I agree with him, you know, for the record. He does lament that. It's like he misses God. His father was a preacher, right?
Yeah, and he was not close to him. He was close to his mother.
Of course, he wishes he could be Anna, because Anna is going to be not just the best person, but the happiest person.
Even though she's lost children. That's an important point we shouldn't overlook. At least one kid, I think maybe more than one, but one for sure has died. She talks about it at one point, she's not with anybody, she's talking to herself, I believe.
She's praying to God to look after her daughter who died, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's implied, I think, why the doctor used to visit the house before, because her daughter was dying. They lived in the house together.
Okay.
There's no husband, so you have to presume that it was like an illegitimate birth of some kind or what have you. But yeah, she has had tragedy, and now she's going to be alone and starting over again after 12 years of looking after Agnes.
And they show a complete lack of loyalty to a loyal employee. Maybe it's a comment on rich people, the way that they give her a little bit of money, and then you can have one trinket of Agnes's. She was way closer to Agnes than the two sisters were, and yet you get a little bit, just a little. Fuck you, you assholes. How do you treat her like that?
I think they just want her out of their sight as soon as possible, because they feel really guilty about the fact that a employee took way better care of their sister than they did. There's a lot of guilt in that script, in those performances, in that home.
And in fairness to the sisters, the movie does portray the impotence people feel when a loved one is dying and you can't help at all. Like I said, I saw my uncle die for many months. My grandfather died of cancer about 10 years before him. I didn't see that happen because he lived in Nova Scotia. I went to the funeral, but I didn't see him when he was going through all this. But cancer has been a big thing in my family, so again, maybe that's one reason I relate to the movie. You can do nothing. You're just there to bear witness. You're a grief mop, as Nicolas Cage says in Bringing Out the Dead. All right, the cast, there's not that many actors in this movie. Almost all of them were Bergman regulars. Harriet Anderson is Agnes. She worked for 50-plus years. She's still alive now, although she hasn't made a movie in 5 years. She was in Through a Glass Darkly for Bergman and Smiles of a Summer Night, and she's also in Dogville, which is a nice little link to Lars von Trier. Hey. The bigger star by far, though, is Liv Ullmann, who was in Persona, well, like we know for sure, one of her great performances, and also Scenes from a Marriage, which was, I think, a year after this was out. And if she was American, she'd be a legend. She'd be Streep or Hepburn or one of those kinds of actresses, because she was great in so many of the Bergman films. I don't know other directors she worked for. I'm sure other Swedish directors. But there you go. There's an actress who people know if they're film buffs, but the average person, no, they don't know that name at all. It's a shame.
And she is phenomenal. It's such a physical performance, and she really pulls it off.
Persona, you've seen that. She's even better in that film. Yes, yes. For sure. Erland Josephson is David. He was in Fanny and Alexander for Bergman, and he wrote a lot of TV movies. Then Kari Sildoan, I guess that's her name, plays Anna. She only made a few other movies, including Face to Face for Bergman, but this could have been Mia Farrow. I didn't read why Farrow didn't get the role, but she was in Bergman's Crosshairs at one point to play the character.
I kind of like that Anna is not homely, but she's really plain-looking. The three sisters are all beautiful, but I think that her plainness is kind of another reason that you underestimate her from the beginning, and then are blown away when you have that different impression of her at the end of the film.
Anders Ek is the priest Isaac, who was not in very many Bergman films, but he was in The Seventh Seal. Henning Moritzen plays Joachim. He worked for 60 years and was in The Celebration, which is not a von Trier movie, but it was one of those Dogma movies. Mm-hmm. One of the more famous ones, actually. And our writer, director, and producer is Ingmar Bergman. He made 38 movies, and a lot more than that, that he actually directed. You look on his resume, and there's all kinds of shorts and TV stuff that he did. But 38 feature films, including the famous Seventh Seal and Persona. So many other great films, though. If you haven't seen his stuff, you really should. Some of it's on YouTube. I haven't looked in a while. Persona, at one point, in a pretty good print, was just there on YouTube. And the Criterion version. I think other ones he's made are there, too.
I think my next one's going to be Wild Strawberries. I think that's the next one I'm going to
check. You should see that, yeah.
Yeah. And he wrote that in Cries and Whispers and in Persona, they were the most abstract films he made. He said he had gone as far as he could go, and that that was working in total freedom, and that allowed him to touch what he called wordless secrets that only cinema can discover. He made weird films, but to the purpose of expressing things that are difficult to express in a traditional way.
This movie could have been done as a silent movie.
But then you would miss the howling of pain.
You see it, though. You get the gist of it.
You say that, and I agree with you, even though it is a rather wordy film.
Mm-hmm. But you could have changed it enough. It's such a stark movie. Definitely resembles The Passion of Joan of Arc by Dreyer back in the 20s. I guess you haven't seen that movie.
I've seen parts of it. But
that's all about intense close-ups and some suffering. Well, a main character, at least, that's suffering. Bergman normally worked in black and white, but look what he and Sven Nykvist, his legendary cinematographer, can do with color. And the movie did win the cinematography Oscar. Bergman loves shooting those huge close-ups that fill the frame. I guess it's the warts and all approach, or the freckles and all approach, if you talk about Ullmann. And he made it work better than most people who have ever done the huge close-ups. I remember with The Contender, Rod Lurie, on the commentary, talks about how, oh, if I'd known better. He was, I think, a second-time filmmaker. He's still new to making movies. And then the shots of Jeff Bridges or Joan Allen, Gary Oldman, these huge close-ups on a big screen are a little bit much. But that's what Bergman especially is going for. I don't think Lurie wanted to be quite that big with his close-ups, but Bergman certainly did. He was his own producer, and like we said, he used his own money. His co-producer was Lars Ui or Ui Karlberg, who was a producer on Passion of Anna, another Bergman film, and many other pictures as well. The movie's 1:66:1. We watched the Criterion DVD. Looked pretty damn good. The cinematographer, I just mentioned his name, Sven Nykvist. Great use of red. He worked with Bergman over and over again, and then later on came to work with one of Bergman's acolytes and a great fan, Woody Allen. Made quite a few films with him. He won 2 Oscars, including for this movie, on only 3 nominations ever, despite being one of the greatest cameramen who ever shot a film. But that is typical for foreign language stuff to be overlooked by the Academy Awards over and over again. The editor, Siv Lundgren, who only cut 12 movies, mostly worked with Bergman, including on Scenes from a Marriage. The movie's short. There's not a lot in it. It's got a pretty simple story. What'd you think of the cutting?
I thought it was perfect. The pacing is perfect, and I love a short film.
And then you got the flashbacks and time jumping, but I think we always know where we are.
There was one point where I was actually very confused, and that was a scene that takes place between Maria and the doctor where they're looking in the mirror and he's describing all the lines in her face. I don't know if that's supposed to have happened in the past or when he's there for Agnes.
Okay, I don't remember that specifically. Maybe it doesn't really matter that much anyway. It's not a huge part of the movie. He does rebuff her. The composer, there isn't one. He just used Bach and Chopin, sparse use of them as it is.
His soundtrack is very rich with sounds of the house.
And whispering, of course.
Whispering, but also Cries and Whispers. Clocks ticking, mm-hmm. or the shuffle of their dress. All those noises are amplified and kind of make up the soundtrack instead of music.
Yeah.
It kind of helps with that oppressive, claustrophobic quality of the house.
The influence was quite a bit from this movie, really just in general from Bergman. We talked already about Passion of Joan of Arc and the Antichrist thing with the cutting off of the clitoris. Oh, I don't know if I can watch Antichrist again for that reason alone. I do want to see that movie again.
I looked away during that scene.
Maybe I'll rent it one day and just look away when it comes up. But how about these connections? Philip Seymour Hoffman's character in Magnolia has a similar "he cares more than the family does"
caregiver too. Role. Yes.
He's the caregiver who cares way more than anyone else, although Tom Cruise does come in at the end. But the other connection with Magnolia, it's just as a whole with the movie. It must have been influenced by Bergman because there's cancer, there's family strife, and at the end there's some forgiveness.
I'm inclined to agree.
And even though we know Woody Allen was definitely influenced by Bergman and made a movie called Interiors after he made Annie Hall, completely different movie than Annie Hall, and pretty damn good one, definitely in the Bergman vein. I've never heard Brian De Palma himself or anyone actually compare himself to Bergman, but I think with that woman suffering thing, but not being an asshole about it, not saying, "fuck you, women, I'm going to make you pay" in my movies. He was accused of that. Bergman may have been too, but I don't think either of them are actually doing that.
I stick by my theory that they just can go deeper and further with a female character than they can with a male character because it's harder to believe a man will openly be vulnerable and express emotions the way a woman will. Just on the influence vein, we have said over and over again that Lars von Trier, in general, his whole career must be influenced.
Well, De Palma, von Trier, and Woody Allen are three directors who've used women as their leads or very important characters at the very least in a lot of their films.
It's funny that you say De Palma because when I think of De Palma now, I immediately think of Blow Up. And when I was talking about the roles that I hate for women, that was actually the movie that came to mind, the girl in Blow Up, the damsel in distress in Blow Up, who is borderline developmentally disabled. She's so stupid and useless.
I don't agree.
Oh, I hate her.
Then again, the movie's about how Travolta handles that anyway, and I think he handles that brilliantly. He was never given enough credit for that role. I think he's fantastic in it. But I think that Nancy Allen was pretty good too, considering she's playing, like you say, a damsel in distress. I think she's given three dimensions. She's also a prostitute. There's a lot of cliches that he's working with there, and I think he makes it work very well.
I disagree. I hate her character in that film. It, like, ruined the movie for me.
All right, the awards in this section for Cries and Whispers. It won the Oscar for Cinematography. It was nominated for four others. Best Picture, Best Director. Bergman was a triple threat, by the way. He wrote as well, and that was nominated. So he was nominated by himself, in fact. There are a lot of people, we talked about it for this year's Oscars, that got multiple nominations. Guillermo del Toro may have won last night. We don't know. We're recording it before that. And Jordan Peele is also nominated. He may have won for the script. We don't know. But in both those cases, they were nominated with other people, at least on producing. But in this case, Bergman was a solo producer. Credited. I mentioned Lars Uwe Carlberg, but Bergman is the only name on the IMDb for producing and then directing in his screenplay. It was also nominated for the costumes and didn't win.
It's quite a big deal for it to be nominated for Best Picture. It's very rare for a foreign film to get nominated for Best Picture.
This was the fourth ever that was. Grand Illusion, Z, or Z if you're British, The Emigrants, and then this, and then later on, took a long time again, The Postman in 1995, Life is Beautiful, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Letters from Iwo Jima, the Clint Eastwood movie, and then Amour. As far as the nomination for Best Picture in 73, it was up against these eclectic titles, The Sting, which won Best Picture, American Graffiti, The Exorcist, and A Touch of Class. What a weird group of five movies. Not bad weird, but just what a strange, all-over-the-map movies that you got there.
That's how it should be, and that's like kind of proof, too, that such a silly thing that we decide which film is the best of the year when you can have these five nominees that are so dramatically different.
The first three of those, by the way, The Sting, American Graffiti, The Exorcist, had the benefit of also being the three biggest hits of 1973.
And they're still classics today.
And Bergman also won the Technical Grand Prize at Cannes in 1973, so it was definitely lauded, this picture. And like you say, the reviews, for the most part, Ebert for sure loved it.
Oh yeah, lots of really amazing things written about this film. There's so much love for it.
So your last thoughts on Cries and Whispers, a movie I've talked about a long time to you, and I wish you liked it more. I thought maybe you would. I thought you were going to look at me after we turned it off and say, wow. Instead you looked at me and said,
Okay. No one's more disappointed than me. Maybe I'll give it another shot years from now when I'm in a better mood for it. I'm going to say this is a compliment. It was very interesting.
Yes.
And I can see why it does resonate so much with so many people.
Well, put this in the I won't watch it very often category, like Schindler's List or Passion of the Christ, those kinds of movies that are hard and you got to earn it. But this is Bergman at the top of his game. He isn't as famous as some of his other pictures, but I prefer this one. Maybe it's all that cancer. I really relate to that.
Yeah, that could be it.
And this is the Bergman that's lingered with me more than the other ones, even though those other ones lingered with me too. Okay, when the Next 100 Project returns next Monday, we'll dig into a rough and tumble world of embezzlement, toe removal, and carpet micturation. We've got Jeff, Walter, and Theodore as the best bowling team in Los Angeles. And the Big Lebowski. There's a build-up for you. Where the fuck's he going with this? We're going to really turn the page here and do some comedy next week. We are going to be unbearably irritated with the quotes.
I apologize.
Dr. Strange level with the quotes, I think.
It's not our fault. Collins just wrote one of the world's most quotable scripts.
I think most people are happy we're going to do this movie. Most people love this movie at this point. It was not a hit at the time. It is now. So the coming attraction trivia for The Big Lebowski. We've talked before about how this movie was only nominated for one AFI list. What was that list?
So for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about The Big Lebowski. And if you crave more Ryan and Bev between now and then, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, which I think is now called Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster of almost 250 podcasts, which include all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. Maybe in exchange for all this wonderful free content, you could give us a rating and a review. We really appreciate that. It means a lot to us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That is one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case sensitive.
I'm going to try this one more time. Viskningar okrop. Hey, I got it. Not bad, huh?
I'm sorry, Swedish listeners. And cut.